18 minutes to 9 Central African time, under the radar here on Radio Islam International. Attorney Sabir Ahmed Jazbar recently shared an article online from the American Institute for Economic Research, and the title of this recent, very fresh article was called "Tyranny During Its Reign is Unrecognized by Its Victims." And I just want to read some paragraphs from here before we go into dissect it and obviously making it more relevant to a world and even a South Africa under the sway of COVID-19 and the regulations that come with it. It talks about how tyranny spreads. And many people, according to this article, think that tyranny comes from an open, blatant dictator. And society thinks that there, like a devilish person will emerge who seizes the levers of power while the nation's people are innocently going about their business. And this kind of dictator, he wears a sinister smile, he twirls his lips, the tips of their moustache in a, you know, a sinister fashion. They impose their criminal wills upon the populace, and so forth. And people who have this approach, they think that when a dictator will arrive, they see that the dictators are evil, but they can't do anything. Obviously, it's a dictator, and they submit, and people are enslaved. And the only way to get out of a system of tyranny is, a new superhero, a knight in shining armor, appearing on the scene, and that person obviously subduing the evil that came from that dictator. But the article actually, turns it around and says that most of the time, dictators do not come, in that evil guise. They come as people who are there to save humanity. They are there to look out for the common interest. And to just quote the relevant portion here, each actual tyrant points to some problem, perhaps real or perhaps fabricated, yet unfailingly exaggerated, the persistence of which will inflict on his beloved people unprecedented harm. He persuades the people to obey him in his pose as a courageous and caring visionary, unafraid to use whatever powers he must in order to save his people from the terrible perils that otherwise await him. And he insists that his exercise of power must be broad and bold, unchecked by legal or ethical niceties, which would only prevent him from saving his flock. So, quaking in fear of these terrible perils and hopeful for the promised salvation, the people submit sheep-like. So, this idea that good causes and genuine crises could be subverted to actually let real tyranny show its fangs. I want to contextualize this evening and ask Brother Sabir, why did he see that to be relevant, particularly from a legal point of view? Brother Sabir Ahmed Jazbar, as you know, is an attorney, he's a part-time commissioner and panelist with various bargaining councils at the CCMA, also the PSCBC, ELRC, etc. And his specialities are as a conveyancer and workplace dispute resolver. Brother Sabir, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, thank you for having me on your show.
A great pleasure, Brother Sabir, and shukran for joining us this evening. Just your choice. Obviously, there are people who are overtly or really go perhaps beyond the bounds when it comes to suspicion and skepticism, sometimes becoming perhaps loony, if you'd like, in the process. But skepticism as well as being suspicious sometimes of the motives of those in power is necessary, especially when there is a basis to that. So what is the main concern and the thought process behind you raising the story of tyranny raising its head in a situation of crisis?
Okay, I think that's a very, very valid and very opening statement. I think it's fantastic and it's quite relevant in the context of COVID-19. Very many times, I've been following our own example in South Africa, and I must use South Africa as an example, and I saw dangers there. For example, when you have an unelected body without constitutional powers, making laws and regulations regarding how and where and what we must do in COVID-19. And Parliament has a very subliminal oversight. And that got me into thinking that this is how dictatorships are born. If you remember, if you go back into history, you see Adolf Hitler use a democratic process to espouse the problem of Nazism. And so did Stalin, and so did many leaders in the world today. So on that basis, I started exploring the situation vis-a-vis the current crisis. And now is the right time for people, for dictators to come about, simply because there's fear and there's doubt and there's skepticism, and he who talks loudest wins the war. That is the sum total of my early submission at this point.
Okay, and you spoke about the historical precedent. It's also important when we talk about South Africa, how the politics of fear played a big role when it came to the sculpting of apartheid. You want to just talk to us a bit about that as well? We can't obviously neglect the apartheid context in anything that happens here as well.
You remember our history? Yeah, our history is such that we come from a very oppressive background, and therefore you have this document called the Constitutional Republic of South Africa. This document makes it very clear how the democratic process works. And I think the COVID-19 has given very many people in power, I use the word in power, an opportunity to try to change the Constitution with a view of fulfilling their own agenda, which they couldn't before because the Constitution is a negotiated document. The only way you can change the Constitution is by having circumstances or to contrive circumstances to bring about this change. And this is exactly what I see the dangers. We have a right now an impartial judicial system, but we have a disjointed, a disconnected police system and an army waiting in the background. And these are dangers that I see in this time of great unrest. If you remember, where earlier on in March or April, the army went on a rampage, literally killing people who did not obey the law. So that is a problem I have. And I got to warn against people that whilst, yes, we have a genuine and real crisis on our hands, we must not abdicate our democratic or constitutional rights and responsibilities to people out of fear and ignorance.
Just try and break this down for us, because there would be perhaps what we could classify as irresponsible discussion, and that's very subjective. Again, many people would say we lampooning them with such a term or such a characterization, but you know, some people would be totally skeptical of everything in the government's response from A to Z, to the extent that the very existence of a virus would be questioned. The every single figure would be questioned, and everything would be greatly exaggerated as well. And the premise of that would say that on a pack of lies, this is a justification for, insert any name you'd like, whether it's the government, whether it's a ruling party, whether it's the pharmaceutical companies, whether it's some global cabal, trying to use this to control society. So that's one type of discourse. I would imagine you're not saying that exactly, and it's not one big conspiracy of the entire world being pulled by strings being pulled by a select few. But at the same time, you are cautioning that something could be subverted, a real crisis could be subverted. Just break that down for us, the distinction between the two.
Thank you very much. I think that's a very, very clear question in the society. If you listen, if you play back your tape sometimes, you'll listen to what I said. I said that people use the democratic process to subvert and to change agendas. Remember, there are issues that cannot be fulfilled, and many socioeconomic rights in this country cannot be fulfilled. I'm not saying that's a conspiracy. I'm saying that there are chances out there. People can use doubt, and they can use ignorance, and they can use a moment in order to consolidate the power. And one has to look at the background to this matter. But I'm never, ever subscribe to this conspiracy nonsense. There is no conspiracy. There is nothing of the sort that is contrived for anybody to take over government, etc. This cannot be, because we have strong democratic process. We have strong Chapter 9 institution. So far from that, I am saying that we, in the moment of fear, in the moment of doubt, right now, if, as I stand to you, I must reiterate, we had, we got almost 103,317 active COVID-19 cases. We had an increase of 9,445 increases in the past 24 hours of infections. I can go on and on. Four provinces make up 92.31% of the total infection rate in South Africa. This is a fear psychosis. And you get people out there trying to warn you, and that's genuine warning. No doubt about that. But in that, you will have some opportunists creating false flag operation, false news, and that person is going to try to make certain, he's going to manufacture content. This is how apartheid consolidated itself in 1970, and that got one of the most insidious laws in the country. So we've got to be careful about this. We have a natural coronavirus that is doing a fantastic job, no doubt about that. But it is dictating to how and what to do. And parliament is not having that oversight. And if you remember, yesterday there was an announcement by an opposition party to that effect. So we've got to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. This going down to some specifics, Sabir, as far as the Disaster Management and Act, and the fact that we've gone very low down the tiers of the alert levels, you know, going from a complete lockdown level 5 down to over the months level 1, but something that has been remained consistent throughout that is the government repeatedly extending the state of disaster here in South Africa. Is that a cause for concern? Do they have practical reasons?
Absolutely. It is a serious cause of concern. You cannot, sorry, you broke up there, but I will try to answer what I heard. There are issues that one got to carefully look at in the situation. The circumstances that we are facing right now is extraordinary. I mean, if you look at the National Disaster Act, I've looked at it carefully. You cannot renew it as much as you did. Somebody has already launched a challenge to the courts whether you can renew it every 30 days in indefinitely. There's got to be a parliamentary process, and that is where one of the situations came. If we remain silent about this, then by fiat, we are now abdicating in favor of something that ought to have been done. Remember, South Africa is premised on the principle of rule of law and constitutionalism. You cannot have a system that obviates and forgets the fact that we come from a past where government certainly used the law, the democratic process, to subvert rights and to take away our rights. And this is my fear.
Is there anything fathomable, beyond the concerns about where this could lead, is there anything fathomable why the government would do this repeatedly? Is there anything that it affords them, some special privileges that are required to be able to fight the pandemic?
Well, these are extraordinary situations. Parliament has not formally sat for a long time. And with COVID-19 regulation, etc., people are operating largely from homes and isolated places. And it's only in certain instances that they live in Parliament. I think basically what must happen, Parliament is now going into recess, I believe. It must happen early next year, and Parliament goes back into session. They should have something about probably amending the National Disaster Act in order for an indefinite declaration of uncertainty. That is a problem I'm having. I'm having an immense difficulty that every 30 days is the figures. Remember, somebody put it very nicely, lies, and statistics. These are important factors. I don't know. I'm relying on the government, on the South African coronavirus, the CEO, the ZD, to give me statistics. I have no other evidence to tell me that is not true. I accept the fact that it is true. But remember, the fact that is how dictators in the past managed to grab and hold on to power. Not that it's going to happen here. This is not my suggestion. I am warning the people against abdicating our responsibilities of challenging, questioning government, questioning the authorities as to whether or not these are the situation. So therefore, people are on the guard. Right now, if you look at the facts, down in Durban, for example, people are absolutely fed up about this COVID-19. The fatigue is setting. People are not even masking. I was in the beach front on the 16th, and I saw, I was terrified when people were openly walking a promenade, not masked. There were not a big crowd, but people were not even bothered wearing masks in an atmosphere where you have the situation. So, my brother, I am not in under any circumstance. I'll make myself clear saying there's a conspiracy. I am, my studies in constitutional law, my studies in development of how demagogues, how people come into power, has warned me that there are the hidden, there are hidden dangers that we must guard against. And this is where the democratic moment in South Africa must come up.
Talking about constitutionality, Brother Sabir, we've got perhaps more than this, but two important judgments here, amongst others, as I mentioned, the one coming in June, where the North Gauteng High Court decided that the lockdown is in unconstitutional regulations, meaning all regulations, alert levels, are unconstitutional and invalid because in a number of instances they are not rationally connected to the objectives of slowing the rate of infection or limiting the spread thereof. And another one that came up very, very recently on the 11th of December, the full bench of the Western Cape Division of the High Court publishing its judgment on the tobacco ban matter. And there, too, they said that the ban was unconstitutional and invalid. My concern is courts have pronounced on this a number of times, but has this brought any consequences for the government? Is it just like, okay, we've lost these cases, we were wrong, but it doesn't seem to be any kind of retribution or any amends or any commitments from the side of government as far as I know?
You know, that's a very relevant question for your listeners. The first case, the one of 11th June that you spoke about, is now, it has to be constitutionally ratified by the Constitutional Court. And that matter has not happened. So until that happens, the decision of government stands. So therefore, that is an instance that we got to be careful about. But with the outcome of the Constitutional Court in that degree. Yes, I follow the judgment. Many of my concerns, by the way, are in some way mirrored in that judgment because of the manner in which they were enacted, etc. Now, as far as the second judgment concerned, I'm sure smokers on your program are smiling all the way to the bank. Again, this is 157 pages to complete this morning. The manner in which government has gone about effecting these changes. Now, remember, this judgment, you're talking about judgment, is merely academic. You know why? Because the government has rescinded its ban on smoking and tobacco. So it's merely a sort of a academic exercise, but it's important for the government, for the constitutional, for the court to mention the fact and for the constitutional court eventually to make a decision whether or not that was unconstitutional or not. The way the government is going about, and these are extraordinary, government is going to argue, I can gather, is going to argue that you cannot have a full debate, a full body debate, even under Zoom, under circumstances that are extraordinary. There are people that cannot be available at any given time, etc. So that is the problem we had. So both these judgments, my brother, are subject to constitutional review. And until the Constitutional Court decides fully and finally, remember, the Constitutional Court is the ultimate arbiter of any constitutional issue. Both cases brought about constitutional matters, human rights matters. And only a constitutional court can declare that to be constitutional or unconstitutional.
The question I'm asking on this as well is there, it's an academic exercise on the one end, but is there any way that it can be applied retroactively in that people had their livelihoods damaged by some of these regulations, sometimes people had their lives lost, etc., because of what is now deemed to be unconstitutional? Are we just going to say it's a chapter in history, it was unconstitutional, the government was wrong, but we'll try to apply these lessons in the future? Or is there any way to take retribution for the government for the losses that were incurred?
All right, I'm going to speak in two tongues here. The first one is very important. Yes, if there's an illegality and is it upheld in a constitutional court, then the affected parties have a right to challenge the government on that point. Whether they succeed is a different situation. I think you need another program to discuss that. The second way I would say that I don't think it is feasible for anybody to bring an action for damages. These are situations that acted in moment of desperation, and the argument that I would use is that we had no way of ascertaining the true measures, the true depth of the disease, and we had to do what we had to do. With hindsight, we ought to have been careful. However, we do not. Now we know better, and we stand by the decision. So there are two ways of looking at the situation. To repeat, the first one would be that yes, they have a right. If there's an illegal, if there's unlawful, unconstitutional, then there's something called constitutional damages that can be afforded. So yeah, there are ways of solutions to a problem. But whether they succeed or not, man, it's going to be a hell of a long time before a court decides, because these are extraordinary situations. They've got to prove deliberate violation and destruction of human rights. And I don't see how that can be achieved in the short term.
I understand that it's obviously it's not that easy. As much as perhaps the layman would like to see some sort of accountability in a direct way, the legal system doesn't exactly work like that, and I appreciate that explanation. Two final questions. The one, Brother Sabir, I know this is going to be a much broader discussion as we enter the new year, and talk of global vaccination rollouts would intensify, and obviously the vaccine coming in a more tangible way to South Africa. Some people are concerned about the fact that there might be a mandatory vaccine imposed. Again, it might be a broader discussion, but just some bullet points from your side to consider in terms of legality. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm not talking about a pro-vaccine stance or anti-vaccine stance, whatever one decides on that. But I'm just simply looking at whether if a person feels that this is not what they'd like to do, can it be imposed on them from a South African legal framework?
I was waiting for this question for a long time for somebody to ask me. No, you will not be forced to take that injection or the vaccine. Your consent will be required. Informed consent will be required in order for you to allow yourself to be, quote-unquote, assaulted. Remember, an injection is an assault. Any procedure on your body is an assault. So you've got to consent to the fact that you want an invasion about your bodily integrity. Remember, the Constitution guarantees everybody the right to bodily integrity. It also gives everybody the right to informed consent. And therefore, right now, if you've been following, there's been at least one reported fatality of a COVID-19 person who took an injection. Apparently, this is reported. I haven't verified this, but there are ways. There are very serious consequences, and therefore, unless and until the information is clear, like your diphtheria injection, your flu vaccination, etc., I don't think anybody in the right mind would readily to have this injection. So they cannot force you. You cannot be forced, legally or otherwise, to take this injection. However, there are consequences where, for example, I'm just merely shooting my head off here. An employer, for example, in a very strategic state-owned company might insist on employees undergoing certain tests, and if they are found to be somewhat subject to the virus, to take an injection if they want to keep the job. That is a possibility that one cannot discount. However, whether that's legal or not, I'm going to make myself clear. I am not saying that's legal. I'm not saying that's illegal. I'm saying that very strategic employers, like your arms industry, your medical industry, etc., will sometimes force, will make this a condition of service that you're coming in, and therefore you've got to be tested. And if you're found to be falling on the borderline cases, you might be asked to take an injection. However, your right to say no is not in any way affected, and that is something that the court will decide. I am making no pronunciation. I'm saying that is one possibility that one cannot discount. That will be crazy for anybody to do that at this point in time. But right now, that's a reality that one got to embrace sometimes in the next year.
But there seems to be a paradox there, if I'm reading this correctly. On the one hand, nobody perhaps might compel you to take it, but if without this you cannot go to work, you might not be able to go to work, or you might not be able to attend school, or you might not be able to travel. Is that not a de facto way of saying you're actually forced to do it?
Again, I must congratulate you for that question. This is very, very valid. I'm telling you, my brother, when you go for Hajj, when you go for overseas, you're allowed to take yellow fever, this tablet, this injection, that injection. Without that, they won't allow you into the country.
Mm-hmm.
If a country like Saudi Arabia or India or Pakistan, whatever it is, say to you, well, to come in, you need clearance. You need not a certificate to say that you're COVID-free, but a medical certificate to say that you've been injected for this virus. So therefore, you won't be a carrier and you won't be a disseminator of the virus. So that is a legality that I think, my brother, let's park it for another time. I will apply my mind and give you a much more definitive answer. But I must congratulate you. You're the first radio station to make these legal issues out there in the open. And I hope that we can have a wider discussion.
Alhamdulillah. Final one, Brother Saber, is just to go back to that earlier discussion, how a crisis could be subverted to give rise to tyranny, dictatorship, unconstitutionality, etc. You have urged vigilance from the public, and this is the importance of active citizenry. As we pointed out, specific instances of unconstitutionality, state of emergency being extended repeatedly, perhaps with no clear basis. How do we respond in a way that ensures that our hard-won freedoms are not lost, and this creates unfortunate precedents that could come back to bite us later?
I like that question. I'll tell you why I like that question. Because, remember, the government has been introducing regulation changes by stealth, by using right now extra constitutional means, using the NCCD. And these are having an effect on violating minor rights. Remember, no rights in the Constitution are unlimited. They can be somewhat limited by law of general regulation. And especially in situations like we are faced right now, the government can reasonably use the COVID-19 the pandemic to introduce certain measures. But the moment you allow minor changes without challenging it, this is the point I'm making. We must challenge, and I congratulate opposition parties for raising these issues. We must challenge these minor infractions of our rights. Otherwise, those that are in the background who are watching the trend might use an opportunity in a moment of crisis to push an agenda that is going to be very detrimental to our constitutional rights.
Absolutely, and again, underscoring the need for active citizenry, vigilance, civil society organizations, NGOs, legal practitioners, etc., playing their part to keep government in check and not always assume that those making decisions have always the best interests of subjects and citizens in mind. Also keep in mind the wider context of corruption in South Africa and how such unlimited powers would be able to feed a cycle of corruption in one of the most corrupt and unequal societies in the world. As Brother Sabir mentioned, there are many other points perhaps to tease out in the future, especially relating to vaccines, constitutionality of forced vaccines, etc. And it's going to be an area of intense focus and scrutiny as the new year dawns. But for now, we leave it at that and ask Brother Sabir to perhaps engage his mind on that. I'm sure he won't be able to enjoy a holiday in full without this kind of thoughts playing in the background. But for now, shukran for your time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Let me thank you, first of all, for allowing me to go and leave tomorrow.
All right, Father Safi, jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.